Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Hello and welcome to The Imprint Companion, the podcast from me, Alexis Teleopoulos, and my dear friend Blake Howard, that discusses the releases of Imprint Films, the boutique Blu-ray label here in Australia. This week we are charting our way through the January 2025 editions, this great new batch of interesting films in box sets and one Lucy. We've got one Lucy in the batch as well. And it is a pleasure going through this box set because it's quite varied, quite interesting. Some great little takes in here. Blake Howard, what have you been thinking of the January 2025, our first recording of the new year, this batch?
Bro, it's great to see you. Happy New Year to you. This batch is a banger. Very luckily, there was an sort of part one of the January batch, which was focused on the Burt Box, because I was very lucky myself to do a video essay on Hustle, a Burt film in there. And it has the Gator dynamic duo of films, White Lightning and Gator, the second film actually directed by Burt Reynolds himself. So it's a really fascinating kind of trio. Really great little batch. But I'm more excited to talk about what we're going to be focusing on in this batch, particularly, I think, one of my new all-timers. You warned me about it.
I knew it as soon as I saw a movie in one of these box sets. A classic example of me whipping out the phone during a movie, start texting the fellas going, you're going to love this one. And Blake was the first to receive a message about a film in one of these box sets. I'll also give a shout out to White Lightning in that Burt Reynolds box set. I watched it, had a great time. Can't wait to watch Gator. Can't wait to watch everything else in there. Hustle, the Iron Burt Reynolds documentary. Lovely Hustle, box set.
Hustle is terrific. I'd really suggest that you watch it. It's yeah, and there's a little video essay by me in there all about Burt at that time and this straddling, I guess, existentialism and entertainment. So I would hope you enjoy it very much. But we're going to focus in this little chat. We might finish, for my mind, the strongest that we can possibly finish. So let's start with little offense to one of the greatest actors of all time, Marlon Brando. Film Focus Volume 2 for Marlon Brando is here in this very box set. Lex and I have plucked out a couple of choice ones in there. I'll just read to everyone what is featured in this box set to start off, and then we'll get into the films. It is The Night of the Following Day, The Nightcomers, Last Tango in Paris, The Missouri Breaks, A Dry White Season, and a really terrific, very recent 2015 documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon, which takes a whole bunch of like personal tape recordings and turns it into a documentary. A real fascinating one I saw actually at the time. I might have even been in like a festival screener or something like that. It's a really cool that it's getting its own disc in this set. It's not just a special feature on others. It's actually part of the set, which is really cool.
I think I remember it playing some festivals back in 2015 when it was released. And it was also just one of those movies I remember hearing about for quite some time, that it was a fascinating thing to have all these actual recordings of Marlon Brando to construct a documentary from it about the man, not just his craft. Found that to be quite a fascinating release in there. But great box set, interesting choices. I always find it interesting when they go to a part two or a volume two in these actor filmography sets. And there is one movie in this set that I would say fits the bill of essential Marlon Brando cinema. Did you have a chance to catch up with The Last Tango in Paris?
I sure did. I plucked two things out of this set. One of them, The Last Tango in Paris. The other, The Missouri Breaks. But let's start with you guys listening to a little bit of a trailer of Last Tango in Paris.
For From director Bernardo Bertolucci, The Last Tango in Paris. Paul, a middle-aged American living in emotional exile, comes to Paris when his estranged wife commits suicide. Chancing to meet young Frenchwoman named Jean, Paul enters into a sadomasochistic, carnal relationship with her, indirectly attacking the hypocrisy all around him and his own feelings of guilt through his raw, outrageous sexual behavior. This is one of the iconic films of Marlon Brando's filmography. It earns him one of his Academy Award nominations and has kind of lived in infamy for ever, really.
Yeah,
I remember seeing this movie quite young because it featured very prominently in the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die. And I think
when
I was around,
I love that you have that as a guide. And I remember the joy of ticking off each of the releases in there. I should re-tick because when I was at university, I was very keen ticker, but I reckon I've seen so many more in there. I would have smashed the rest of that.
Don't tick too much, Blake. When you get to 1001, you know what happens. Once
you've
seen
blind.
Them all.
You get blind.
Luckily, they do new editions that put The Greatest Showman in there and other movies that you might not get a chance to watch. So there'll always be a future for you. You'll never die after seeing those 1001 movies because the 1001 keep changing. But I remember seeing this one back then, obviously because I loved Marlon Brando. I loved The Godfather. I loved his classic films in the 50s era, Viva Zapata, etc., etc. And this was like such a curious one because I think it was one of the first true art house experiences I had. Those really raw things, too young to be exposed to something like this. I don't think I even held a hand at that time. But it just like, it's such a shocking film. You seeing it now, many, many years after hearing about it, had you seen it before? What kind of power did it hold for you coming back to this film?
I saw it a million years ago and I basically had no memory of it other than some of the more gruesome, I would say, scenes
that truly live in infamy. Talking about a scene in this film that has been written about so many times by journalists and critics alike.
Yeah. So, but seeing it again, it's one of those things because Marlon Brando plays Paul. Paul is a deplorable character. And this film comes out in 1973. And it feels like a true era where Brando is doing lots of different films. And we're going to talk about another one where I think he's doing something the same, which is he's embracing the reaction of an audience. And he has gone past any desire for an actor or a performer to be loved. And instead, he wants to cause the most visceral reaction. And with Paul, it is pure disgust and distaste and this kind of like abject horror at some of his behavior. And especially because the text of the movie, what I found so fascinating, because Lex alluded to it, but this film has very, very aggressive sex scenes and very confronting sex scenes in the film. And Maria Schneider, who is Jean, who is the female lead of the film, came out much later and said that Bertolucci and Brando really kind of sprung some of the most heinous scenes in this movie, which are already very confronting, sprung them on her in a way as a performer in order to elicit an even more kind of disgusted and vulnerable reaction. And in many ways,
a quote unquote honest reaction, which I don't think holds any water when you're with actors, because actors can fucking act. You don't need them to be surprised.
Whenever I read something like that, I always think of there's a fantastic scene in Ricky Gervais's Extras where Ian McKellen goes, "You know, I'm not actually a wizard. What I do is I pretend. I go home and in that moment I pretend." And he's like, "Yeah, that's what acting is." So I completely believe her. And I feel like Bertolucci and Brando, like there's a subplot in this movie where Jean is like her fiance is a filmmaker who's making a film about their life and their love affair and coming up to get married. And she hates being his puppet and she hates being manipulated and she hates it. And I was like, this movie's subtext is also its text. Like the filmmakers are manipulating this person. She does not want to do the things that they are doing to her. And they're kind of, it's this metatextual torment on top of actual torment on top of the text of the movie. And it's a really hard watch these days, Lex, to be honest. Like the rewatch is, it's tough. It's like whatever admiration you can have for the levels of commitment of Brando wanting and desiring almost to be detested by the audience who are consuming it, it is also disgusting. It's kind of it's a harder watch. So I just want to, content warning, people be prepared. If you've never seen Last Tango in Paris, you may want to see it to sort of tick that off a list or something like that as a curio. There's a really good there's a couple of really good interviews on there. There's one previously unseen video interview with Bertolucci, which is just a fascinating document because it's still very much him being lauded for it. It's him, he was banned from going to Italy for releasing it. The film was banned for many years. There's lots of journalism about it. For many years, it's unavailable. But it's a tough watch, and I found it this time, like, it's so hard to watch it knowing everything that you know about it now and seeing the manipulation of what's happening and not see that, like, the entire exercise is almost confronting Maria Schneider's character with everything that happens in this movie. It's an orchestrated manipulation of many things. It's a really hard watch. It's hard to recommend. It's a this is genuinely a hard. It's a tough one to recommend. As fascinating as Brando's performance can be, it's a really hard one. But it's if you're a in the journey as a cinephile, we're going to go through many experiences, as we often do, of like art people that we don't necessarily respect as people creating great art, and that's a great conflict of art. And so I think that it's a worthy thing to have, and it's a worthy thing to view, and it's a worthy thing to watch as an exercise. But it is ugly. And I think the ugliness is closer to the surface than I think probably you can give it credit, or previously people may have sort of alluded to it. I think that people were, as far as the content, they were confronted by it. But I think that the actual exercise is, it's a very tough one. So yeah, it's a hard one for me. It's one I won't be in a hurry to revisit. Although, so much of it is such a magnificent, it's a magnificent exploration. And it's nowhere, it's and by kind of content terms, it's way way more tame than one of my favorite comedies of all time, Short Bus.
I just for me, I'd seen this movie when I was a teenager. I just was not ready to stomach it just yet
No.
to revisit it. And I appreciate it being this box set because it's like, it's an interesting film. It's historically significant and should be seen by people like you and I who care about
Yeah.
films and care about exploring cinema. And I always appreciate when Imprint has new special features
Yes.
applied to classics like this. And on here, we've got like three new interviews. One with a film critic, Piero Spilla. We've got one with the editor, Roberto Perpignani. I'll say that again. With editor Roberto Perpignani. And then one that I'm more particularly into is called Of Tango and Light, interview with camera assistant Mauro Machetti. And I think whenever they get someone who was really below the line to come back and talk about a film, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, because they seem more candid. It's got a lot of years under its belt, and so they get permission when all of the participants are basically retired or dead that they can be as candid as they want about it. So yeah, but that Bertolucci unseen video interview was a fascinating one for me. That was a really fascinating thing because at that point he was still so he felt like there's none of the baggage that we're talking about there. That is in him at that time, which makes it all the more interesting and I think and curious to look at. But let's dance the hell away from this topic and let's jump into the next one. Let's have a listen to a quick trailer of The Missouri Breaks.
Brando. Nicholson. The Missouri Breaks.
You have the lips of Salome and the eyes of Cleopatra.
We ain't gonna do it because I said we ain't gonna do it!
Now, am I perfectly clear on that, Cal?
I do not. And Jane does not. And the dozen dotes who work for me do not steal horses.
But somebody does, don't he?
Yeah! Adios, amigo!
Do you want me?
Why?
This is what your heart. Your heart.
Get your hands, sir, is on me.
Where's your Creedmoor at, Robert Lee? Where's your cabbage-shooting Mexican pistola with flowers on the handle, Robert Lee? Why don't you go get it?
Marlon Brando.
Well, that settles it.
Jack Nicholson.
Get off! Get off!
In an Arthur Penn film. The Missouri Breaks.
Arthur Penn's The Missouri Breaks, when vigilante land baron David Braxton hangs one of the best friends of cattle rustler Tom Logan, played by Jack Nicholson. Logan's gang decides to get even by purchasing a small farm next to Braxton's ranch. From there, rustlers begin stealing horses, using the farm as a front for their operation, determined to stop thefts at any cost. Braxton retains the services of an eccentric sharpshooter, Robert E. Lee Clayton, played by Marlon Brando, who begins ruthlessly taking down Logan's gang. Lex, The Missouri Breaks, a Western that stars two absolute titans of American cinema, Jack and Marlon. What was it like going back to Missouri Breaks?
I would say going back to Missouri Breaks is kind of interesting because I had seen this probably around the same time I would have seen Last Tango in Paris. I remember working at the video store, Mondo Movies in Andale. Beautiful store. I'll shout it out every time. Even though it's gone and will never be seen of again.
I was born and lived in my first house was in Annandale.
Lovely spot and a great store. And we had like quite a decent Westerns collection there. And I remember just stumbling across this one and being so intrigued with the pairing of Brando and Nicholson. Because they do kind of, at least the way that Hollywood saw them and audiences saw them, they do feel that bad boy image or that playboy image, or and also like an incredibly talented craft redefining actors for their respective generations. And I always just remember, you know, hearing all the stories about them together and like who they were and always being very curious about it. I remember seeing it and remember thinking it was good. Revisiting it, unfortunately, there's so many things in here that should tick boxes. Jack Nicholson, Brando, Arthur Penn, freaking score by John Williams.
Yep.
And I think I find this film disappointing.
And there's just one guy that I also want to mention. The legendary Harry Dean Stanton is in this movie.
Oh, my God. It's a monstrous cast.
And Frederick Forrest, Randy Quaid, mm-hmm. Kathleen Lloyd, but the ones that got me, Harry Dean Stanton playing off Jack at this time, I mean, I was just like gobsmacked.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. It's interesting because you know what I thought of going back to it? Do you remember the M. Night Shyamalan film Old?
I do.
In that movie, repeated throughout, the Rufus Sewell character keeps on talking about a movie starring Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando, but he can never remember the title. And I just remember seeing that movie going, it's Missouri Breaks. And I just remember seeing with my friends, kept telling me, is this movie called Missouri Breaks? It's a Western. And just kept on going like, it's Missouri Breaks. And then rewatching Missouri Breaks, I remembered that from Old. And then I tried to go, what was the significance of that? And M. Night Shyamalan said that he's also never seen Missouri Breaks. But his dad, who was a doctor who started exhibiting dementia, he would keep on asking about that film and bringing it up. And he goes, Dad, if you bring up this Jack Nicholson, Marlon Brando thing one more time, I'm going to have to put it in a movie. And then he did.
Oh, my God. That's a wonderful story. Yeah, look, I want to say this. Missouri Breaks, the pedigree of this movie is absolutely insane. We mentioned Arthur Penn. If you don't know that name just off the top of your head and you're like, who the heck is Arthur Penn? I mean, I'll give you a couple. Bonnie and Clyde, simple as that, 1969, yep. Little Big Man, so many other things, like a true Night Moves. Oh, my God. Unbelievable. Unbelievable
yeah,
movie. We may get a chance to talk about that soon. Unbelievable movie. The thing I like about Missouri Breaks as like an acting exercise is that you have a thieving cattle rustler who clearly has killed guys, goes on and starts pretending to be a rancher and almost gets caught up in the performance of being a rancher. So like Jack's guy and even his men who are played by, as we said, Randy Quaid, Harry Dean Stanton, Fred Forrest, they have this thing where they're like seeing their man, Tom, just like start like being a rancher, being a farm guy. And they're like, you know, this is just a front, right? Like has your brain gone or something like that? Mm. And then the great thing is that John McLean, who plays David Braxton, who's the head guy, he hires Brando. And he's such a curio, like fancy guy, comes in with all these weird eccentric clothing choices, affects a whole bunch of weird accents on purpose, depending on who he's talking to throughout the movie. You don't sort of send, you know, has all these strange disguises. But, and so he sort of like wants to be this very delicate and sensitive thing, but he's also just the most ruthless, amoral killer. He doesn't care if he gets paid. It's kind of like almost like a Javier Bardem sort of No Country for Old Men proto, where he's doing all this weird stuff. He's not like he's not as comfortable being himself. He's always affecting these different performances, but it's like these two guys get pitted against one another. And I know that the movie doesn't completely work, but when it is working, when Brando, when the movie really works is kind of the final act of the movie, when you know, all hell breaks loose and it becomes sort of a mano a mano. And there's a great tagline on the front cover of this Blu-ray that's so sensational. One steals, one kills, one dies. I think it's just so fantastic. When it turns into that, I was completely riveted. Has one of the coolest death scenes I think I've ever seen in a movie. And when, and you know, Harry Dean Stanton, you know, and all of his crew, they go through all these different moments and you see the peril that they're in. It was just something really special about it in some moments. And it really breathes and has a lot of life in it when these guys sort of cast away the facades and really lean into their strengths. And so I think it's like it's a weird cure of a movie. It's a weird exercise of a movie, but I can totally see the appeal for both those actors to be like, I'm going to be this person at the beginning of the movie. And then when the movie starts, I'm putting all these facades over and I'm going to pretend to be something that I'm not. And then when the world tears away at all those facades and they have to become who they are again, that's where the movie's the most interesting. So it's this weird like bookending effect where in the middle, you're like, what the freaking hell is going on in this movie? But at the end, by the end of it, I was like, man, that was really worthwhile. And I might skip a whole chunk of that movie the next time I watch it, but I'll be in to watch Jack go full vigilante cow rustler mode. And I'll be in to watch Brando go full Anton Chigurh. Like that was my takeaway from this. I was just like, wow,
yes.
Those two things. I'm like, if I could convince anyone, I'm like, if you can just wait and be patient, and I know it might be a slog with all these movies, what's fantastic is, you know, rarely are they more than 2 hours. This one's just like kissing the 2 hour mark.
Just a little edge over.
Just a little tiny smidge over. But if you can wait for that last sort of half an hour, it packs a wallop, and I really enjoyed it. It was it was a surprise to me because I enjoyed it quite a bit.
It's one that I would know that I'll revisit it again one day. Like just even everything you said, I go, yeah, I agree with all that stuff. I should give it another shot. I watched it like a week ago. I'm back.
You know what's funny is like you do that to me so much. I'm like, God damn it. Maybe I need to rewatch it. Maybe I was in a bad mood, but I was really geared up for this. I was in the mood. So, you know, and I love a Western and I love a revisionist Western. It's so, so good. All right, Lex, we might jump on to the next one in here. One that you checked out for the first time in this, and I didn't get a chance to yet. It is The Night of the Following Day. All right, directed by Hubert Cornfield. A gang of four professional criminals kidnaps a wealthy teenage girl from an airport in Paris in a meticulous plan to extort money from the girl's wealthy father, holding her prisoner in an isolated beach house. The gang scheme runs perfectly until their personal demons surface and lead to a series of betrayals. Lex, tell me about The Night of the Following Day.
I won't spend too much time on this one, Blake, but there is, I think this one is worth exploring, especially for you, Blake. I think that you will get something out of this. It's got an interesting cast, Marlon Brando, and obviously, of course Marlon Brando's in this movie. It's in the Marlon Brando box set, but Rita Moreno's in this as well. And from what I understand, this point in history is kind of significant because it's kind of the last film that cements Brando's position as an outsider of the system that makes it hard for him, but also possible for him to be booked to be Don Corleone in The Godfather.
Like, oh,
this
great.
This is a bit of an oddity. It's a crime film, completely fascinating from a craft perspective because it has this very like European style, like more European New Wave than American New Wave. And right. from what I understand, Hubert Cornfield is not really a well-known filmmaker. He's made like a handful of other films, but nothing I'd ever really heard of before. But that is the thing that's interesting about it. It's also just curious watching Brando the entire time because he is... He's doing something interesting. Like, he's just doing something really quite interesting. And I'm finding it hard to articulate what it is. He's playing with shape in his, like, physicality of this character. It almost feels like the kind of movie that Ocean's 12 is riffing on. You know how Ocean's 12 was a little bit more European New Wave than anything else? It feels like this might be the film that's riffing on. That's what it felt, at least to me, discovering this. I don't know if I loved it, but it's the one that I'm just like, of this set, this is the one I go, I will be seeing this one again within a couple of years because it just, there's just something about this that's curious and makes you want to go further. And there's also on this disc, like an entire documentary about Rita Moreno, feature documentary.
Right.
So you're getting your bang for your buck in this, getting a full Marlon Brando documentary, full Rita Moreno documentary, so much more. But the night of the following day, weird little crime film.
It's going in.
A cavalcade of character actors being put together. This is the one I'd recommend for you in the set, Blake, that you haven't had a chance to get into.
Love it. Let's jump to the next set. Blaxploitation. Features. Two movies that are sequels to one another. The Legend of Black Charlie. The Soul of Black Charlie. Superfly TNT. And Detroit 9,000. Let's start with one that is a hard letterbox one to log. The hardest to log.
Yes, as I so put it when I logged it in and was shocked to see what the original title of this film was.
The Legend of Black Charlie is not known as The Legend of Black Charlie on Letterboxd. It's another word and is being intentionally confronting. Let's start out with the trailer for The Legend of Black Charlie.
Somebody warned the West. Nigger Charlie ain't running no more.
If he sets one foot on this property, Nigger Charlie will kill him! Kill him!
Charlie, a slave who kills a white man in self-defense, heads west towards freedom while pursued by a professional slave hunter. This film is most notable, the first film in a trilogy of interesting blaxploitation westerns by Martin Goldman, the director, but starring one of the most significant actors of this 5 or so year movement of exploitation cinema, Fred Williamson.
Yeah, look, Fred Williamson, such an incredible, towering, gorgeous man at the time, has his key friends that sort of take off with him. This film, there's
one of them
about...
being Sidney Ling, mate. From Finding Desperado.
Wait.
Yeah. Fred Williamson came up quite a bit in our research. Almost tried to interview him for that podcast.
Oh my God, Lex. That is the... You know how many times I listen to that show? A lot. Your show. Your voice.
Every time I see Fred Williamson, I think about Sidney Ling. Every time.
Every time. Lord Sidney Ling. Let's give him the credit where he's due. This is what I want to say. The great thing about blaxploitation is that it sort of exercises revenge, you know, and you see that through this like systematic oppression of black people and obviously the 400 years of like actual oppression of being slaves, when they start to, you know, break into cinema in the blaxploitation era, that they are playing in mass entertainment, but it's also loaded as hell. And it's also a very cathartic thing. So like all these absolutely shitbag, awful slave hunter characters and people who oppress, especially, you know, Fred Williamson's character, Charlie, they get their comeuppance. There's also beautiful black women. And of course, what happens to with a beautiful black man and beautiful black woman are together in this movie? They fool around, and it's there's boobs and there's violence and there's guns and there's revenge. And I was watching this and I was like, you know, as much as Django Unchained is, you know, credited a lot to Django, I'm like, Quentin Tarantino knows he's making a blaxploitation movie. Like he's looking at things like The Roots, which are the much more, the much more contemporary, much more, you know, philosophical, much more like unity minded things, and going, I'm abandoning this idea that revenge isn't what, and comeuppance isn't what these people deserve. You know, these people who are, you know, treated these oppressed people so awfully. So I had a great time actually with The Legend of Black Charlie. This is the thing you can be sure of. It's like my wife walked in when I was watching, I was halfway through the movie, and there's a great scene where there's this one of the slave hunters is pursuing them across the country, comes and, corners Charlie and his friends in a saloon. And he eventually gets his demise. He gets gut shot. And I was sitting next to my wife and I go, watch this. There's no way this guy's just going to die being gut shot. And then he gets a double barreled shotgun in the chest and flies out the window. And I was like, see, black exploitation is one of the most satisfying genres of all time for that very reason. You're like, it is there to entertain you. It's the kind of Rudy Ray Moore, like, you know, skin flick kind of entertainment. It's except with violence too. It was just great. So I had a really good time and I'm so stoked that I can check out the sequel. I know there is another sequel as well, but and again, all of these super hard to log because of their original titles, which we won't be using for this show. But I had a really good time with this and I was like, yeah, Fred Williamson, love him. He rules. I can't wait to check out the sequel as well.
I think he's quite excellent in this film. Like, otherwise, this is a very classic Western. He's a very, very classic Western. But Fred Williamson's charisma is just fantastic in this. He towers so tall. And I had seen the third in this trilogy before, Boss, because it's kind of more known as, like, the Fred Williamson film. Yeah. But there's a little bit more nuance in here. There's a little bit more, like when we say classical, it's like it just plays quite beautifully. It looks quite nice. The transfer is quite lovely. But it reminds me of the Australian film based on the Thomas Keneally novel directed by Fred Skepsie.
The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith.
Yes. It reminds me of The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith.
Big time.
And I'm saying that in quite a favorable way. I think that's a masterpiece.
I love that movie too.
And I think there's a lot of
spiritual sequel, Red Hill.
Killer,
no filler here.
Absolutely. I think this is quite special. And I think I'll speak to this whole box set as a whole before we even move on to our next thing. I think this is an excellent set. Interesting to have different flavors. You've got two much more urban set blaxploitation films that are quite typical of that genre and that movement, but then you've got these two westerns in here as well that are more atypical but also essential, because you've got one of the most essential stars of the movement in this, all accompanied by a brief history of blaxploitation, the interview with Josiah Howard, who is an author of blaxploitation cinema. This is, I would say, because it doesn't, there's something about it that makes this quite interesting, this set, because it doesn't have a Shaft in it, it doesn't have a Coffee in it, it doesn't have like a Pam Grier film in it.
Yep.
These are less iconic blaxploitation films. And I think there's something really important in giving these ones a chance and exploring in that movement further. Because we just see the headlines when you hear about an exploitation movement like spaghetti westerns. You hear about Sergio Leone. You might hear a couple of other ones because Quentin Tarantino made a movie called Django. So you might hear about Django. But like, you may hear The Great Silence. Otherwise, there's hundreds of movies you don't hear about. I think having a blaxploitation box set without the headliners in it is much more special and much more interesting for it. And these films, it lets these films stand on their own in a much more interesting way, which brings me to,
And I was just going to say, which goes to three massive boxes and our poor little loner that is hanging on by a thread on the end of these boxes in the January batch. It goes to now my absolute favorite film of this entire box set, even better than the film that I did a video essay on. And I wish that if I had a do-over, I would go back and write an essay or do something for this incredible film that we're about to mention. You listen to the trailer. I'm going to tee Lex up to start talking about it. It's Detroit 9000.
9000, 9000, officer in trouble.
Trouble? When you got the biggest ripoff of the decade in the murder Police. Capital of the world, you've got more than trouble. You've got disaster.
A gang of gun-toting goons have staged a daring big-money ripoff at a high-society fundraiser for the state's first black candidate for governor. For the two Detroit cops assigned to solve the caper, politically charged corruption and violence then explode in what turns out to be the deadliest case of their careers. This is directed by Arthur Marx. Orville Hampton is the writer. It stars one Mo Green himself, Alex Rocco, Harry Rhodes played Sergeant Jesse Williams. They're the two cops, white and black. Has an incredible loaded cast. Scatman Crothers pops up in there as a reverend. It's got some Vanetta McGee as Roby Harris and then Herbert Jefferson Jr. as Ferdy. Excellent supporting cast. I'm going to go down and shout them out as we talk about it. Stacey Keach Sr.'s in there as well, which is crazy. An excellent cast, a banger of a movie. And a movie that caused Lex to text me and said, I just found one of your new favorites. And he hit me right between the eyes. Absolutely nailed it. Lex, tell me about your feelings of Detroit 9000.
I just loved this film.
Loved.
Exactly what I'm talking about with not having these great all-time iconic headliners in this box set. Allow something like Detroit 9000 to really sing and to really be seen on its own terms and its own merits, because you're not comparing it to the other films of the genre or the film movement in its whole. I thought this was freaking excellent from start to finish. I had such a good time with this film. Firstly, I'll talk about Arthur Marx, because he's a filmmaker whose film, a few of his other films I've had seen, an exploitation filmmaker, Bonnie's Kids, I thought is an excellent exploitation film from 1973. And then also JD's Revenge, which is probably closer up to that iconic, just slightly edging out of like the prime spots of blaxploitation, 1976. So kind of after the movement's had its peak, it's just in that little outskirts area. But that's a 1940s gangster film with Lou Gossett Jr. That I think is quite good. I remember seeing that on DVD or Blu-ray many, many years ago, and I thought it was excellent. But Detroit 9000 is fantastic. It's so gritty and edgy, and the violence packs a punch. Like every shot, every squib that goes off, you really feel the power of that. And it's that kind of like gritty urban cinema that, you know, the 70s does so well, but executed in a point blank exploitation style that just sings beautifully. You've got Alex Rocco, fantastic actor, best known as Mo Green in The Godfather, getting to do a starring role like this. He's just like effortlessly cool and charismatic, but also he adds like a workman quality to it that, like, you know, if this was a big movie, Pacino would be in this kind of role or someone. And there's something more interesting and more grounded and more real about Alex Rocco being in this. Just, I can't say enough about this. The last thing I'll say really is like the score. It's got this really great jazzy score that just works the whole way through, but it feels less obvious. You know, there's like a certain juxtaposition to the score and the screen in this. Love this, Blake. There's a reason I texted you about this movie instantly. You're now saying that you probably love this movie even more than I do. So I'm not even going to prompt you. I'm just going to give you the floor.
Honestly, there are some movies that I've come to say are like genre busters, and I feel like they break genres. And there are other movies that are so in their genre, but they are flexing so hard on it that they extend what you think of what it can be. Like this is this is disguised as like a trashy blaxploitation film, and it's a heist film that has amazing racial like conflict. Like there's the racial conflict that's really tangible that's going on in Detroit at the time. It's got these really beautiful ambivalent things of these like different strata of society bashing up against each other and all these conflicting emotions and motivations. It's got really rich and detailed characters that have awesome backstories, some of which have like weird interconnections. It's got awesome twists and turns around the way. It has one of the best staged heists I've ever seen in a movie. And you're talking to a person
who's Mr. Heist.
Mr. Heist himself. Mr. Heist myself, right? And I was just like, I was blown away by it. I thought it was sexy. I thought it was slick. I thought, I love exactly what you said about Alex Rocco. It's like, you need him to be schlubby and grounded, and you need the weight of the entire world on his shoulders. The urban, like, warfare almost, like the cops and the tracking these different guys and watching, you know, big machine guns running around a city and see what that does to, like, different units of cops. Absolutely insane. It's, the violence is so visceral and awesome. And it's just fucking unfathomably entertaining. Like it runs, this movie is an hour and 47 minutes, so it's basically 100 minutes ish with some credits, flies by, and it's just so riveting and entertaining. And truly, like, at the end of the year, I'm just putting a pin in it. I'm like, yeah, this will be in the top five. It would take something unfathomable to push this. It's like all the things I love. It's, there's such a tactile experience of Detroit at the time. There's something so great about the whole look and feel of the city and all of the different people in it. I love everyone in the movie. I love everything that they've got to do. Like Robert Phillips plays the captain, Chalmers, who, like, you know, gets Lieutenant Danny Bassett, who's Alex Rocco's character, onto the case. He gets Sergeant Jesse Williams together. You know, there's so great. Vanetta McGee is Robbie Harris, this, you know, this call girl who has sort of had a fall from grace. She's really educated and she's, you know, gotten into some trouble hanging around some bad people, but has connections with Harry Rhodes as Sergeant Jesse Williams. It's just these just interconnections. It was just great. I just loved every piece of it. I was like, this is exactly the kind of thing that I want to see. And it flexes so hard that it's like pushing itself into kind of like French Connection territory for me.
Yeah. You know?
Like it's not, the distance between Detroit 9000 and the French Connection is not that far away. And for me, I was like, this movie is, it was like a missing link in a chain between those huge genre pieces of like urban crime thrillers that became super popularized and prestige, and blaxploitation, because I feel like blaxploitation pioneered so many things that were later adopted and absorbed into the wider crime genre. But man alive, it just ruled top to bottom. Like, it may be best Detroit movie all time. Like, you know, used to be Robocop for me.
Come on, Robocop.
Used to be Robocop for me, but it's like, look, it's so good. It's like truly this year, I've watched a lot of movies and some revisits, but it's, as a new movie to me, this is absolutely my favorite movie of the year. Like there's no question. There's no question.
I knew it within minutes. It was like the first scene that I texted you, man. It was the first scene. I go, oh, he's going to love this one. It's just, it's excellent, excellent cinema. Not long after this, I rewatched Coffee. I'd compare it very favorably to that as well. One of like the true hardest genre films of all time.
Yeah.
Be a great pairing with them. I love you comparing to The French Connection, because I think because this is like dirtier, nastier, cheaper, it feels more honest than The French Connection in a weird way too.
Yeah, there's
This is like
the style is so like, I mean, Friedkin has such an amazing command of like vehicular style in that movie, which comes to define it. But like, just the how you traverse the geography of Detroit with all these sequences is just so magical. I love the Detroit you saw in this, because it's completely unfamiliar to me, other than much later's Robocop, which is like a, you know, a harrowing, you know, dystopic Detroit as well. But, oh man, I was just, this rules. It just rules, 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 top to bottom. So we've already sort of pretty emphatic about, you know, if you're a Brando person and you're a completist, you're probably going to pick up, you know, Film Focus, Marlon Brando Volume 2. If you're a Burt person, you know, that 70s Burt period of White Lightning and Gator, obviously, you know, those two are connected because they're sequels, and Hustle. But if you want some genuine surprises and just like something to kick your ass, like I would, and I'm in the set of the Burt set. My number one recommendation for this month is Detroit 9000. And if the only way you can get it is in this Blaxploitation box set, you have to pick it up. It's my favorite thing in the set, in the whole batch.
I agree with you. Whole batch. And I would even say, I think that this box set, if I could rename it, I'd rename it Blaxploitation Discoveries, because you don't have the items, you don't have your shafts, you don't have your Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, you don't have coffee. You get space to discover new pleasures for any person that is familiar with any Blaxploitation cinema. This is all new, really all new stuff in here. It's so good, so excellent. Superfly TNT, we didn't even talk about it.
No.
But it's a sequel to one of the icons. And I didn't even know there was a sequel to it. I assumed there was. But it's like, this is such a good box set. Loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. Can't wait to keep watching it, keep exploring further. It inspired me to want to get back and watch more Blaxploitation stuff.
100%.
And I think a great way to do it would be to continue watching some Arthur Marx. I'm going to rewatch JD's Revenge. He's made a few others that I might stick into. And hopefully, Blaxploitation Volume 2 is coming eventually. That's what I'm hoping.
I'm going to do exactly what you said. I'm overdue for a rewatch in Detroit 9000. I watched it days ago. I'm going to watch it with coffee as a double feature, as per your recommendation. And just like pour over the rest of this box set, because it was just so riveting and so great. And I it has the coolest art. Also, the poster art is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. So I just think it flexes so hard. It opens the genre up to new and more exciting places. It's not just, it's not just violence for violence sake. It's not just, this conflict that's sort of orchestrated to have this sort of racial thing. It just feels, I don't know. It just, like I said, it feels so much closer to the French Connection than any other Blaxploitation crime movie I've seen. And that is the biggest compliment that I can give it.
That is our Imprint January batch. We talked about Blaxploitation. We talked about Burt Reynolds Volume 1, his Film Focus. Marlon Brando Film Focus Volume 2. And there's also another film in here that we didn't get a chance to see, but I'm curious about it, but Walk Like a Dragon, which is, I guess, a Western. Wow.
Look at that. Look at us. Maybe a little cheeky Western we can chuck on as well.
Yeah, okay. Might have to get to that eventually, but that is our January bundle. Thank you for joining us here on the Imprint Companion. We've got more riches coming down the line from Imprint, so we'll be getting into our next bundle pretty soon. We just received our test disc today. I'll say it on the record. So we're going to start watching, getting them to you very, very soon. Blake Howard, keep checking out his wonderful work on One Heat Minute Productions. And my name is Alexis Toliopoulos. Thanks for joining me. Check out my podcast, The Last Video Store, and come check me out at the comedy festivals this year with my show, Refuse Classification.
I can't wait to see it. I'm going to get tickets to that Sydney show and be there cheering you on.
Cheer me on the entire time. I want you roaring my name. But Blake, always a pleasure to spin those discs with you, my brother. And I can't wait to do it again.
I can't wait to do it again. And please never forget, when you see a banger, you immediately text me. You break all the rules of being in a cinema and you text me and say, my man, you need to watch this movie. You've been so on the money.
I've never been wrong.
But the two highlights of my time recording podcast with you about physical media, Breaking News and Detroit 9000.
Mate, I got a couple more that I texted you recently. I've got them. I'll give them to you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you did text me about one recently. Yes.
Yeah. And we'll do a little bonusy episode when you watch those. We might have to do something.
Yes, we got it.
Oh,
should I
just say what they are?
Yeah, say, I'll give
one of them.
Yeah.
Prime Cut. I just watched this movie, freaking Leave Marvin and Gene Hackman. Fucking knocked my dick into the dirt. Great movie. And then another one I just watched. I can't remember if I texted you about this because I texted my little crew of this other one. Sudden Death.
Oh, Sudden Death
JCVD.
Rules. Oh, yeah.
My God, dude.
Great movie. Great movie.
My God. How did no one ever tell me about Sudden Death in my whole life?
Bro, I wish that I knew you when I was a kid, because I reckon I rented Sudden Death 40 times from the video store when I was a kid.
Oh, my God.
One of the greatest movies.
It's a diehard ripoff
in an
ice rink. Is better than Die Hard. And no one told me about this shit. It's so freaking good, this movie. Die Hard, set in a stadium during the grand finale of the hockey league or whatever. And it's so
it's fucking
fun.
Good. so good.
And it's shot beautifully.
Yeah.
Peter Hyams, the whole thing's anamorphic. The whole movie, he shoots anamorphic. It looks insane. And it's really fun and funny. And JCVD's amazing.
He's killing it. He's so good.
They make
him
French Canadian, and it because for the accent, and it's perfect because it's hockey.
Yeah, perfect.
It's so good, better than Die Hard. I'm saying it.
Huge.
But also, I've seen Die Hard 10,000 times in my life, so it's kind of lost its luster for me. It's one of the rarest perfect movies of all time, seamless perfect movie. But Southern Death. Fuck me dead, brother. It's so good. No one told me about it.
I'm really sorry. I really let you down.
You know how I found out about this movie? It was on sale on Amazon. I go, oh, interesting. I'll pick that one up. Watch it that night. Holy shit.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.